All right, welcome back to Media Matters. I am your host, Bob McChesson, here in WILL AM 580 in Urbana, Illinois. Got a live show for you today, and our guest is a gentleman named Art McGee. Art McGee is a communications, media, and technology consultant with over 15 years of experience in both the corporate and nonprofit areas. Mr. McGee is currently the coordinator of Anti-Racism Net, an international network of racial justice activists and organizations based in Oakland, and he's a co-founder of the presently forming Media Justice Network, which is a national coalition of communications, media, and technology activists. He has a lot of experience working in new technologies and in doing progressive politics and organizing. It is a pleasure to welcome Art McGee to Media Matters. Art, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Bob. Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us. And first off, Art, for a lot of our listeners probably unfamiliar with Anti-Racism Net, why don't you tell people a little bit about that?
Well, basically, Anti-Racism Net is an online or electronic portal site that's designed to be sort of a central resource for anti-racism and racial justice-related information. It's actually a project of an organization called Project Change, which was formed of approximately 10 years ago. And the Anti-Racism Net site was sort of one of the initiatives that Project Change launched as part of the work that it does in various communities around the country, training people in an anti-racist fashion, both in terms of anti-racism in specifically, but also integrating it with other types of organizing, such as labor organizing, or organizing around other sorts of social justice issues.
Yes, could you give some examples concretely of some of the stuff that the Anti-Racism Net's worked on? Could you?
Well, we were actually the project itself is actually in a new phase at this point. The main work that it was involved with was helping to promote and to disseminate information about the World Conference Against Racism, Xenophobia, and other forms of discrimination that was held in September of 2001, I believe it was. And that was one of the main projects that Anti-Racism Net was involved in. It helped to supplement and sort of serve as a central repository of quite a bit of the information that was coming out of that conference, both leading up to the conference as well as after the conference. And whereas there was information that was available directly from the United Nations or available directly from different non-governmental or non-profit organizations, Anti-Racism Net served as a sort of central place where people could come to find information from all these different sources. And so that was like the thing, sort of how the network made its name, so to speak. Now it's currently in a new phase where it's transitioning and trying to sort of expand its reach and focus beyond just the sort of core community of people who do racial justice work and anti-racism work for a living, and trying to take a lot of these ideas and concepts behind that work and popularize them and make them more, part of the general public's vocabulary.
Yeah, so where would you say the status of that is at this point? I mean, do you think this is a real problem that this country has, is getting that understanding of anti-racism and those concepts into the heart of the political dialogue?
Yeah, I think it depends upon, I think I would say that the problem is not so much getting the idea into people's minds, but it's the definition of the idea that's the problem. Mm-hmm. In other words, that the way that anti-racism or racial justice is presented in a sort of mainstream context, it often is sort of limited very narrowly to the idea of tolerance or the ability of individual people to live together and to sort of quote-unquote get along with each other.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of becomes the sort of limiting scope of what most people understand as anti-racism. Whereas the approach that organizations like Project Change and many others come from is much more about understanding how it's partly a personal, interpersonal relations issue, but even more importantly, it's a structural issue, that there are institutional forms, rules, and structures that keep things in an unequal and unbalanced state, and that in order to address them, they need to be sort of looked at and analyzed explicitly, that they won't just go away simply because people are sort of, you know, having fun together or interracially mixing, that it's beyond the ability of people to sort of individually fix the problem.
Now, what do you mean by structural factors? I mean, that's a term you hear a lot, or at least I hear a lot, but I mean, I suspect a lot of our listeners aren't, that's not a sort of term they're throwing around over the dinner table.
Right.
What can you put that in other words or explain that or give an example of what you mean by structural factors that you're interested in changing?
Well, I mean, there's so many examples. I guess, you know, a good example might be, for example, looking at, say, the I guess the sentencing laws around, say, drug, you know, in terms of looking at drug policy. And you look at, for example, say, the sentencing laws in terms of how sentencing is handed out based upon the, you know, the criminal justice and sentencing for drug offenders. And if you look at sort of the disparities in how it's determined, you know, a particular sentence for a particular individual based upon the type of drug, for example, that disparity tends to hit people of color and other communities more hard than it does sort of the mainstream or sort of the quote-unquote white communities. And that's an example of the type of thing that's not simply about, you know, people's interpersonal relations, but it's about the way that the laws are written, the way that our government is structured, the way that our institutions, the way that our companies, you know, and other organizations are structured, the way that they're laid out, that those are the things that need to be addressed.
We're talking to Art McGee today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're talking about the Media Justice Network, which Art McGee is a co-founder of, and the Anti-Racism Net, which he works at now. And we're going to be talking about one of the core structures in our society, the media, today in our program. The number here, if you'd like to call in and speak with Art McGee, is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. And Art, let's talk about the media. This is a main focus of your work over the years, and especially now it seems to be an increased focus with the formation of the Media Justice Network. What is the problem with the media? Why your interest in it?
Well, I mean, my belief and the belief of a large number of other people is that probably the most critical factor in, you know, understanding our democracy here in the United States, in being able to, you know, both understand it as it presently is, but also to you know, figure out the best way to change it or to modify it or to, you know, move forward with it, that the critical factor in all that is the media. That the media, and I mean the media in a very broad sense, I don't mean the media just in terms of, say, a particular television station or, you know, a particular television network or radio network, but I mean the media in a broad sense, both broadcast media, as in, you know, like I said, radio, television, as it's broadcast, like you're listening on NPR now, but also media in terms of media production, that people having the ability to create movies using, say, digital video cameras or you know, other consumer products, that the media sort of in general, this whole mass, is really the key to being able to move forward and to continue to improve and actually get to a place where we have what I consider to be a real democratic country.
Well, what's the problem with the media today, in your view?
Well, there are a number of problems, and I want to emphasize that these problems didn't just start today, or they aren't just a recent development. Although I realize that for many people, the current climate and situation concerning the media is considered to be extremely critical. As an African American person, and many other African American people view the issues having to do with media and its sort of, you know, the problematics of media to be something that have been a part of the country for hundreds of years. Number one, and I'd say particularly addressing the current situation, you have a case where there's a heavy concentration of media in a small number of hands. You have extremely large corporations that pretty much own the majority of the broadcast media outlets. Now, this might, on the surface, people might say, well, is that really that big of a deal? And I guess it's one of those things where this is, in order to really understand, you have to sort of look at different studies, some of those studies and research and historical material, some of that you yourself have done, but many other people also involved in that work, that looks at sort of the history of media and gives you a fuller picture of what both the historical consequences are of that concentration, but also what the future consequences could be of that concentration. It affects us now. It limits our choice, our ability to truly have a kind of democratic dialogue between the citizens of the country. And this is one of the reasons why so many people are so fired up and energized at this point in time around the media issue in particular, because there's no way we can actually have a real debate about how the direction the country should go unless we've got a free and open media.
You know, one of the core issues getting to that has emerged in the past several years has been the decline in the number of our radio and television stations that are owned by African Americans, that this number has plummeted, especially in radio, which had its ownership rules loosened up dramatically in 1996. And if I'm not mistaken, you might know the exact figures are, but if I'm not mistaken, the percentage of American U.S. radio stations now owned by African Americans has fallen from roughly 3 or 3.5% to 1 or 1.5%. Because the big companies are allowed to get bigger and bigger, and they're buying up all the small station groups or the single-owned station companies. Is this an area, an issue that you're concerned with, or what's your take on the issue of African-American or broader ethnic minority ownership of broadcast media?
It's in fact a very important issue, but it's important in a way that you might not be aware of. I'd still call them a colleagues of mine at an internet publication called The Black Commentator, put out recently a very brilliant analysis of just that very issue, specifically addressing it in the radio sphere around sort of the loss of ownership by African Americans of radio, of radio stations, and they wrote this particular analysis as a response to a more mainstream piece that was done in Black Enterprise magazine, which is a magazine that focuses on Black business ownership and entrepreneurship. And the thing that I felt was very insightful about this analysis that the Black Commentator put out was the fact that ownership alone is not the solution, or rather it's not simply the answer, that you both need a diversity of ownership in terms of ethnicity, but you also need to take into account a diversity of ownership in terms of ideology or perspective, that simply putting things in the hands of people simply because of skin color is not going to solve the problem. I'm often in conversations with many African Americans, and we look at the contemporary political situation in the United States, and for many of us, probably being somewhere from center to left on the political, spectrum, we look at people like, say, Colin Powell or Condoleezza Rice as clear examples that you can't necessarily pick your friends based upon skin color. It never was the case, but they are sort of examples of the fact that it's even less so now.
And in fact, just to interject one point before you go on, Art, the CEO of the largest media company in the world,
right, AOL Time Warner,
Richard Parsons is an African American.
Exactly. And so this goes back once again to the issue of structural change and not just individual change. Simply diversifying based upon skin color will not in and of itself solve the problem. It's a piece of it, but it's only a small piece. The other, it has to do with perspective, ideology, et cetera. Diversifying that in addition to the ethnic composition of ownership, that then will give you a greater diversity of voices on the radio. I mean, personally, often myself, I'm often, even being an African American, I'm often diametrically opposed in terms of my perspective to a number of other African Americans who you may hear on the radio, even those who you may think are you may label as politically progressive. So it's that's to me is I think a real key is that it's not just about giving some individual people the keys to radio stations. We need to actually look at the structure of how ownership is considered. In other words, we need to look at alternative, and this may be a little bit radical for many individuals because I realize that here in the United States, you know, we have sort of this focus on sort of individualized ownership and property ownership. But from my perspective, if we really want to look at changing the media and how the media operates, we need to look at possibly some form of collective ownership that might or community-based ownership of radio stations so that they would still be owned and be controlled by a particular community, but it wouldn't just be in a single individual's hands. It wouldn't be at a particular single individual's whims to make changes and to possibly ignore the needs of a community.
We're talking to Art McGee today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Art McGee works with the Anti-Racism Net. He's the coordinator of it, and he's one of the co-founders of the presently forming Media Justice Network, which we'll be talking about throughout the show. If you'd like to call in and speak with Art McGee, the telephone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, and the toll-free number is 800-222-9455. And Art, you just raised some really interesting ideas about the idea that just having more diverse ownership or spreading out the ownership of television and radio stations is part of the solution to the problem, but not by any means the lion's share of the solution. And you suggested maybe collectively owning communities, collectively or cooperatively owning stations, things like that. What are some of the other ideas that you've been kicking around in your discussions as sort of the solutions to this problem, tangible things people can think about to get the discussion going and to do the hard organizing around?
Well, I believe that it's a two-pronged effort that needs to be that in order to accomplish sort of the goals of a really truly diverse media. Like I say, one is on the, I guess you could say, the actual policy level. We need to have laws in place that more clearly guarantee the people certain rights in terms of the media and how it's controlled or how it's regulated. I believe that one of the key things is that we need to start to look at media in the same way that we look at the idea behind a lot of the human rights issues that many people focus on these days. When we look at having the right to be free from, you know, being beaten or having the right to food and shelter, et cetera, these are different types of concepts that you see talked about in an international forums. That I believe that media and the right to the ability to communicate needs to be elevated to the level of a right.
Now,
go ahead.
Well, I was just saying that the group you work with, the Media Justice Network, mm-hmm. has just come up with a declaration. Mm-hmm. If I'm not mistaken, is that sort of mm-hmm. try to address that issue?
Yes, that's a piece of it. Yeah, that's definitely a core piece of where our perspective is that. The idea of communication as a human right is something that needs to be talked about and discussed more here within the United States. It's a very common conceptualization in other countries. Many sort of nonprofit civil society or non-governmental entities are, debate and talk about that issue on a daily basis. But here in the United States, this concept of communication rights or communication as a human right is much less widespread and has been up to this point pretty much limited to a small core group of activists.
Well, what would you characterize then as the dominant or mainstream view of communication rights in the United States if the one you've just outlined is sort of marginal and not very widely recognized?
I think pretty much in the United States in particular, I think that the idea of communication rights is still framed in a consumer context, which is basically that we maybe have, that everything is privately owned. That, number one, is never something that is never challenged for the most part. Everything is privately owned. There may be a few, spaces left on the in terms of, say, broadcast spectrum or broadcast media. There may be a few spaces left for sort of not-for-profit media and discussion, and that are the main sort of right we have is consumer choice, that we basically we can take it or leave it. If we don't like something, change the channel, and that pretty much sums it up for, I'd say, the majority of people, that they don't necessarily understand a lot of the ideas, or maybe they don't have time in a lot of cases to really delve deeper into things such as the idea that the airwaves or the spectrum through which radio waves and television waves pass are actually a public resource, that they are owned by the public, or rather they're owned by no one, and therefore no one has a right to own them or lay claim to them. That's the type of thing that is not really predominant here in the U.S. in particular, I'd say.
We're talking to Art McGee today on Media Matters, and the phone lines here, if you'd like to call in, the 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. We have a couple callers, so let's go to the phone lines now. Decatur, you're on the air with Art McGee.
Hello.
Hello, go ahead, sir.
Yes, I agree with Mr. McGee 100%. I'm white, and I used to be racist. And I feel that racism is the greatest cancer in this country. I was introduced to racism in 1963 when I was drafted in the Army. I went to Fort Polk, Louisiana. I couldn't believe it. I got separated from the rest of the guys. I was the only white man that lived north of the Mason-Dixon line, or only person. And I couldn't believe the degree of racism. And I joined I'm a member of the NAACP. I got a Silver Life subscription, and I'd like to thank Mr. McGee for his efforts.
Well, thank you, sir. I wanted to say, you know, what's interesting about when I'm doing this particular work around anti-racism is that often people make the mistake of thinking, and part of the problem is the sort of the way that issues get framed in a mainstream context through, once again, we go back to the media, is that too often the discussion about why racism is bad is simply about because it hurts people of color, and that, you know, the focus is strictly on the complaints of people of color. But what people don't really understand often, and particularly from the way that I approach anti-racism work, is that I actually have a bigger, larger goal in mind. My perspective and my belief, and this is not unique, is that the one thing that's prevented this country, and if you look in particular at certain regions of the country, say like the United States South, from being better or from getting better economically and environmentally and in other ways has been racism. That both in terms of, but in particular, the effect it has had on the ability of people to gather and work together and organize and to strategize together, that racism is the one thing that has prevented there being a much larger struggle for social justice that would benefit everybody, white people and everybody else, not just black people, not just Latino, Mexican Americans, but everybody. And that, to me, is why I struggle against racism, because it's the thing that keeps the division going, that then keeps everybody separated and weak, and that if we had this racism out of the way, if we could really understand it, you know, acknowledge it, and then work together to move forward, we'd actually be able to make things better for everyone. I talk about this same issue when I'm, you know, discussing the issue, for example, even around reparations. You know, it's on the, you know, that it's the issue of reparations is not simply about, you know, for example, handing out some checks to black people. The issue of reparations is about healing the past. This is about really truly healing the past so that we can all move forward together. And I think the problem is that in the way that the media frames issues, it only looks at it from a us versus them perspective, and never allows for other perspectives to be invited into the dialogue, and therefore you just get this conflict that you only see one particular framing of a particular issue. But from my perspective, all this work, whether you're talking about reparations, anti-racism, and other forms of racial justice, it's all about getting us to a point where then we can move forward and actually make this a better country. You know, for me, as a person who, in many ways, people might label my politics as radical or quote-unquote revolutionary, I'm actually about getting the country better. I love America, and I'm trying to make America better than it is. It's not about, you know, love it or leave it. It's about I love it so damn much that I have to stay here and work to make it better.
Well, on that note, let's go to our next caller, who I suspect loves this country, too. Line one, Urbana, you're on the Earth, Art McGee.
Well, I'll reserve judgment on that.
Okay.
I think that I'm very much in favor of more diversity in media. I think it's important that we all learn different perspectives. And I also have a question about, you know, the kind of veneer that takes place where you have certain issues that appear in the media, but without, as the guest has stated, representation. How many African Americans work for WILL Radio?
I don't know.
Count them.
Okay. Hello? Caller? Are you there, Art?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, I think we lost our caller, unfortunately. He was referring to the station we're broadcasting on, the NPR
right.
affiliate.
Oh, and don't make no mistake. I think if his point was is that even amongst sort of nonprofit or progressive media, there are issues and problems with diversity, I would definitely agree with the gentleman that my comments about, you know, around the need for a media diversity and media justice, they apply equally to the mainstream media as well as the quote-unquote alternative media. No one is immune from this. there are issues in all areas of media.
You know, Art, on that sort of point, one of the main themes one sees in the media today, in the dominant media, the commercial media, and also in the dominant public media, is the widespread critique of the media as being liberal, that the media is too left compared to the American people, too sympathetic to African Americans and poor people and women and the environment, and not sufficiently reverential towards military interests or large business interests. Numerous bestsellers, Bernard Goldberg and Coulter, have been written along these lines. The chap from Fox News on the right, Hannity, have written books along these lines. Bill O'Reilly, similar argument. You, I suspect, have heard this argument. How do you respond to the case that the dominant media, in fact, are liberal and, if anything, are biased towards extreme sympathy towards the plight of those who are the victims of racism?
Well, you know, I almost feel like the whole issue of the media being liberal is almost like a trick question, because
okay.
on the one hand, it assumes that there is a particular perspective that operates in a vacuum, and that there hasn't been a battle over a number of years that people of color and have been involved in, and other people, to try and get some sort of much more representative or respectful coverage of their communities in the media, and that is what you in fact may see reflected in the media in general, but that doesn't necessarily reflect a particular bias on the part of the media. It just simply reflects the fact that, you know, you've had people, you know, rioting, protesting, and struggling for, you know, a number of years, and so that they've actually been able to wake people up to the fact that they're human beings and that they deserve a particular amount of respect. So from my perspective, often what I hear in those complaints is that they feel that the media doesn't do what it used to do, you know, pre-1950s, that there isn't enough. It was what they're really saying, and this is just my interpretation, is that it's not like the good old days when you could sort of just, you know, tear into people unjustifiably, and so that now you have this sort of, you know, decency and humanity that you accord people, but that, in fact, is, in what they would label as a liberal value. To me, it just seems like common sense in a lot of cases. But even beyond that, the idea of liberalism itself, I don't think, is necessarily the most amazing, radical stretch anymore. I mean, depending upon how they frame the issue, from my perspective, to them, liberal could simply mean that they don't call gay people faggots. You know, that's to them what they probably mean by that. But from my perspective, the media still has a particularly, different specific currents, rather. I'll say that. It still has specific currents of ideology that predominate and that are, the same no matter what. When you talk about support for business, major business, when you talk about support for the military, and you see examples of that just looking at our, recent history here in the U.S. with the war in Iraq, and the whole, September 11th and all that went on post-September 11th, that it's obvious that there is a dominant ideology in the country, but that it's just not as virulently, hateful as a lot of these individuals who complain would like it to be.
A couple of years ago, a prominent sociologist wrote a book called Why Americans Hate Welfare. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I'm not familiar with it specifically, but I'm familiar with the concepts, what he talked about.
Yeah, because what he argued, his name's Martin Gillens, is that he did a study of the press coverage and the media coverage of debates over welfare support in the United States over the past 30 or so years, looking at dominant media coverage of the issue and looking at public opinion and support for welfare. And what he found was, and I don't think it's necessarily a surprise, but it was quite, nonetheless, he found considerable evidence, was that when welfare was perceived as a general program that served people in need, it had tremendous amounts of support. Mm-hmm. When it was seen as largely a program serving poor black people, paid for by white working people or white people, it was not a popular program at all. And that the media coverage went a long way towards determining how people saw it. That press coverage that emphasized African-American poverty well in excess of the actual number of African-Americans as a percentage who receive welfare, tended to create a very negative attitude, that when it received more accurate portrayal of who actually received welfare, it actually wasn't that unpopular of a program among the American people. It seems that this is something that helped people down on their luck or who need help. And the solution Gillens recommended at the end of the book was that the solution was to put more African-Americans in newsrooms, that there was a degree of insensitivity to race that was just a natural byproduct of having significantly European-American or white newsrooms. And I think this sort of gets to the point the last caller was getting to. What's your take on that issue?
There's no question that, I'm sort of connecting it back with what I was saying before about diversity, ethnic diversity being one but not the only component. I definitely, like I said, think that, having a more diverse newsroom has, over the time, helped to balance things out and give a more fair, result in a more fair approach to coverage of issues dealing with or, having some sort of racial, quote-unquote, angle to them. So it's definitely been made an improvement, and I think that even more diversity will improve things more. However, as I say, I go back to my previous concern that alone will still not solve the problem. There was some incredibly insightful analysis that occurred as a byproduct of the scandal around the Jason Blair and his lying at the New York Times. And one of the most interesting ones had to do with sort of someone who actually went and looked at Blair's background and delved deeper into why he was able to get away with what he had and why that it took so long for them to sort of look at him and say, this has to stop. Now, in the mainstream, you had a lot of complaints about affirmative action, mm-hmm. about, letting black people slide, not holding them to the same standards as everybody else. But what this particular writer pointed out was that in terms of Blair's life, the reason why he got away with so much is that from a cultural perspective, he actually fit in so well with the dominant culture, the dominant white culture in the New York Times environment, that in fact that's why he was able to slide by for so long. If he had been the sort of stereotypical black person that is conjured in the minds of people about lazy and lying and et cetera, that he would have been gone quickly. But because what the people who hired him saw was themselves, that's why he was able to get away with it for so long. In fact, and so, I mean, it was kind of, you know, very blunt, but essentially what the man said is that culturally Blair was white, and that's why he took so long for them to get him out of there.
We're talking today to Art McGee on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have our lines open if you'd like to call in. The telephone number here, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. In upcoming weeks, we're going to have a lot of guests I think you'll be interested in. Next week, we're going to have Francis Boyle, law professor here at the University of Illinois, who's been an expert on human rights law, and we'll be talking about the campaign to impeach President George W. Bush and the press coverage of that campaign, the media coverage of it here in the United States. In September and October, our guests will include Noam Chomsky, who I don't think needs an introduction to many of you. Jim Boughton, who, I don't know, are you a baseball fan?
Yes.
Jim Boughton, you might recall, was the pitcher who wrote the book Ball 4, a pitch for the Seattle Pilots in 1969,
right.
And has written a recent book called Foul Ball about the corruption of local press coverage in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, where he currently lives. We've also got Katrina Vandenhoevel and Molly Ivins on tap, and Stephen Marshall of the Guerrilla News Network. So if you're interested in learning more about our program, we have a weekly email that's sent out to anyone who wants to get onto our list, and we don't give these email addresses to anyone. You won't get any spam or any commercial stuff. All you need to do is let us know you want to do it. And the way to do that is to go to my website, and you'll see a link right on the homepage. And my website is simply robertmcchesney.com, robertmcchesney.com, and click for the Media Matters weekly update, and you'll get it. But our guest today, as I said, is Art McGee from the Anti-Racism Network and with the Media Justice Network, the emerging group dealing with media and social justice issues, combining them and taking it, I think they hope, to the next level. Art, let's talk a little bit, if we can, about the state of African-American politics. Because I know that before working in this area, you were one of the co-founders of the Black Radical Congress, and it's obvious from your comments today that your interests extend far beyond media to broader questions of social justice and political justice. Where do you see the state of African-American politics in the United States at the present time? And put it in context, if you will, over the past 10, 20 years. Where do you see the trajectory being?
Well, first of all, let me just clarify that I wasn't a co-founder, although I was one of the early members of
okay.
the organization.
One of the early members.
Yeah, or one of the early members, but not a co-founder.
Okay, doke.
But in terms of the, you know, the state of black or African American politics here in the United States, you know, it's I wish I actually had a crystal ball to give a, you know, a sort of a better so I'd have a better insight into where things might be going. I mean, there's been such a tremendous amount of change looking back over the last couple of decades, you know, particularly if you start at the point of, say, you know, just before Jesse Jackson's, you know, run for a president, and you look at sort of all the energy and excitement that existed in the late 70s, early 80s around the Rainbow Coalition and how that also fed off of, you know, Harold Washington's you know, mayorship in Chicago, that there was a point there at which African Americans were very, you know, thrilled, energized, and excited, both in terms of electoral politics, but also in terms of grassroots organizing. It was really a sort of, I hate to go, you know, start reminiscing, but it's like, you know, it's really kind of seemed like a special moment. But over time, you know, with the Reagan Revolution and this sort of and then you had, you know, Bill Clinton and his sort of duplicitous politics, it seems like quite a bit of the energy in sort of larger black politics has been drained. And so from my perspective, I'm seeing that it's not really about sort of the larger political landscape where you're going to see the most energy or where the most change is going to come from. In other words, when you look at sort of like the traditional Democratic Party, you know, back and forth, or, you know, tug of war, rather. You know, the whole thing with Sharpton and all the other mess that goes on with the Democratic Party, I've almost kind of written a lot of that off as being sort of the place where you're going to see the energy. And you, and I'm looking more towards a lot of different grassroots independent efforts around the country where people in sort of forming their own particular organizations and collectives of people to both discuss as well as, you know, agitate and work and organize at the ground level. I think that's where you're going to see a lot of the work coming. Like I said, some of it is, you know, work that I did in the organization called the Black Radical Congress, but there are many other organizations and groups of people similar to that that don't necessarily fit in with the sort of traditional idea of a quote-unquote black Democrat or what we traditionally think of as black politics.
How does this relate to the labor movement? And I ask this because oftentimes in mainstream discourse, the labor movement is sort of seen as overweight, middle-aged, or white guys, and not sort of disconnected from the African-American community and a lot of other communities, when, in fact, as I don't think you will be surprised to hear, the vast majority of African Americans are working class people, and they're a significant part of what would be called the labor movement. How important is linking up those causes to the political project you are working on?
Well, I think it's very important, but I don't think, you know, it's one of those things where someone I know who does labor organizing in immigrant communities came up with a brilliant analysis of sort of the difference between sort of the traditional labor organizing model and what we have today. And he pointed out the fact that, you know, he was doing some, you know, sort of just in general conversation, but also more formal surveying of people that he's interacted with as an organizer, that often the last thing that they identify themselves as being a labor union member or a worker, that they think of themselves in terms of other formations. They think of themselves in terms of specific cultural formations, you know, being like, for example, you look at hip-hop music or hip-hop culture, that being sort of a subset of African-American and Latino culture, that being sort of a site of struggle around which particularly a lot of young people are organizing around. And the issues that they deal with are very key to labor, but they're not necessarily thinking in that traditional labor organizing model. It's kind of ironic. No, I wouldn't say it was ironic, but it's just interesting, too, because I think part of what might help to bridge some of that gap is sort of a little more history. I think one of the problems is that a lot of the history of black people and their involvement with labor organizing is often hidden. Or they only see it, like I said, and this is the, you know, the problem with sort of the way traditional politics has been handled is that it's turned people very cynical. But if you go back and you look at sort of all the dynamism and the energy that came out of Detroit and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, or you think of, you know, the struggles that people like Paul Robeson were involved in around labor organizing and the labor movement, that history is something that most young black people are kind of cut off from. I was just watching an incredible movie. I don't know if you've seen it. I hadn't actually seen it before, but it was new to me, but I recognized that it was a classic movie called Native Land.
No, I don't think I've seen it.
Yeah. You say you have?
No, I don't think so.
Tell me
a little bit about it.
There may be other people in the audience who are familiar. It was filmed from 1941, just prior to the war, so it kind of got swept away as World War II came along. But it was just, you know, an incredible movie just talking about sort of, you know, a lot about the history of labor organizing and you know, other things. Just that's the type of thing that's, like, say, it's often missing from the education of a lot of younger folks, that they only see labor in terms of sort of its more bureaucratic form now, and they don't have that understanding of the fact that the reason they only can work 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week, is because of the struggles of people back in the early 19th, 20th century. So I think that making those connections, making it more clear that history, as well as the labor movement being more flexible about where it goes to find people to organize or how it approaches organizing, that'll be key to sort of making those connections more specific.
Art, tell us a little bit about the Media Justice Network, which you're helping to form, which is just getting up and running. What's the vision there? What are the plans? What's this all about? What should our listeners know about it?
Well, the basic idea behind the Media Justice Network, and I guess to simplify it, is to say that we're very much modeling it in a certain way on something called the environmental justice movement. And basically what we're doing is that there's a larger movement of people in the country specifically that are trying to democratize the media landscape, trying to diversify the ownership of media outlets, as well as increase people's competency and skill level around being able to produce their own media. And so with us, we've looked at one of the major problems with this sort of larger movement is that often we don't feel that it addresses certain issues around race and class and gender explicitly enough for our taste. And so we've decided to sort of launch this network. It's not really a new organization per se, but it's a network of individuals who are coming together to try and work on some of these other issues around race, class, and gender within media organizing, both to strengthen our own work, but also to help inform the larger movement for media democracy. And that's sort of the gist of it.
It's still sort of in the formative stages, as I understand.
Yes, very much in the formative stages. We've sort of just right now had the basic statement that we're planning sort of a retreat to have, so that there's like going to be an initial core set of organizers who are going to come together to think about some of the basic issues and further other demands or principles that we'd like to lay out. And then sometime next year, we want to have a larger gathering, a kind of summit, so to speak, of gathering of people to come together and to really lay out sort of where we're going to go in a longer-term sense.
Yeah, well, when you do that, of course, we'll here at Media Matters, we'll want to be covering that. Tell me a little bit about the Internet. You've been active in using the Internet and working on the Internet. What role does the Internet play as an organizing tool for the Media Justice Network and for the Anti-Racism Net?
Oh, well, it's very much a key part of the work, although it's not the only part. I still, as much as I depend upon the Internet in all the work I do, there's still very much a need for face-to-face organizing. Nothing can ever replace having that personal contact with people and getting to know individuals personally. But from a technology standpoint, the Internet has been, and I'd say even before the Internet, because I was involved with doing similar types of organizing work before the majority of the public had Internet access, when most people were using dial-up bulletin board systems going back to like the early 80s, that electronic communications in general that has been accessible by the public has been an incredibly important piece of the puzzle in helping to democratize the media. I was just relating to a friend of mine recently about how the generation that I grew up in did not have quite the same relationship to television or public access television as some of the previous generations, because of the fact that we didn't view it as being as open and as accessible to a whole community as it might have originally intended to be. But for us, the idea of the Internet and cyberspace was the thing that really energized people like myself, you know, when I was like in junior high school, that we really sort of excited us about the potential, this sort of, you know, this decentralized structure that was built upon, you know, these phone lines and wires, that really excited us about what it could mean for sort of a larger media vision.
Is there a website that our listeners can go to if they want to learn more about what you're up to and media justice or the Anti-Racism Net?
We're still working on putting up our website, but if anyone wants to get more information, they can email us at info@mediajustice, one word, .org. So that's info@mediajustice.org.
And I should tell folks once again, if you do get that weekly mailer from us, we'll have this on the weekly mailing, so you don't have to write this sort of stuff down. Links to, in fact, all sorts of links to Art McGee's work on those weekly mailers. Art, we've only got a couple minutes left, and I'd like to ask you a question. What media do you use to sort of stay on top of the world? Where do you turn to sort of get a view of the world that you're satisfied with in our media culture?
I'd say I pretty much get most of my information from the Internet, but particularly via email. I'm still very much a heavily invested in email. A lot of the things I know there's a lot of hype and discussion about, you know, this new thing called the weblog or the blog that a lot of people are talking about. But for me, email is still my prime means of information sharing and gathering. People sort of passing personal notes and tidbits of information between each other, both directly and over larger discussion groups. That's where I find so much of the most valuable information that comes my way.
Are there websites that you visit on a daily basis or on a frequent basis to sort of stay on top of issues?
Quite a few, although I'd say like sites like the Black Commentator, that would be an example of one where I'd probably go to quite a bit, because I find the analysis and the insight very correct or very clear. From that particular publication.
Mm-hmm. How about any books you've read recently, or any authors you've read that you've really been inspired by or learned a lot from that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Not recent books. I think a lot of what I'm reading right now is more historical in nature. Particularly, there's some. I was talking originally about that whole issue of human rights. Communication is a human right, and there's an international gathering coming up in December of this year in Geneva, Switzerland. That's a United Nations gathering that's going to address some of those issues around communication rights. And what I've been doing is doing some historical reading, looking back at some previous quote-unquote battles around media and communications on an international level. Particularly in one in particular was the controversy between the United States and UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and I forgot the other two.
Cultural organization
back in the 80s when during the Reagan era, the United States pulled out of the UNESCO as a form of what they said was protest against its sort of anti-democratic or anti-free speech proposals.
Mm-hmm. That was the event in December, for our listeners, is the World Summit on the Information Society. We will have a program on it before it takes place in December.
Right.
You know, Art, I hear the band tuning up in the background.
No problem.
That usually means it's time for me to clear out of the studio.
I want to
thank Art McGee for being our guest today. We're going to stay in touch with Art. He is one of the co-founders of the Media Justice Network. My name is Bob McChesney. I want to thank Juice McPickles and Hambone for their support, and I want to thank Brett the engineer, and Andrew Boyle, the producer. And I'll see you all 1 week from today with Francis Boyle. Take care.